Welcome to the Modern Woodworkers Association, a podcast about woodworking from folk who woodwork. Woodworking is what we do, who we are, and what we like to talk about. So join us as we have a drink, sit around, and talk woodworking.
Hi, and welcome to the 342nd episode of the Modern Woodworkers Association podcast. I'm Kyle Barton, and I'm here with my co-hosts Sean Wisniewski and Mark Hicks. Today, we're visiting again with Gary Rogowski, custom furniture maker, author, director of the Northwest Woodworking Studio, and host of the podcast Splinters with Gary Rogowski. So welcome to the show, Gary.
Thanks.
Or should I say welcome back.
Yeah, thank you. No, it's good to be back. Good to chat with you guys again.
Absolutely. Oh,
fantastic. Well, Gary has some new things upcoming with the Northwest Woodworking Studio, but before we get to that, let's see what's happening around the woodworking news. So first off, I want to thank our new patrons. You can, of course, if you want to support us, we are on Patreon, and you can find that at patreon.com/MWA podcast. And we really want to thank all of the listeners that have decided to support us. It's really helping out, and we've been quite pleased with the response. So thanks again.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Moving right along, Bosch has a new track saw out, which I thought was interesting.
New Bosch has a new one. Have they ever had one before?
I don't think they've ever had one before. I know a couple other manufacturers have. So I think this is their first track saw, and it's on their 18-volt system, so it's a cordless track saw. And it's fairly interesting. But I think it would mainly apply to those that are already in that, I guess, Bosch community. So because I was looking at
which
the price.
I am, but okay. that's a hike, you know, like.
Yeah,
I've got the 12 and 18 volt right. drills. I'm purely a drill, Bosch drill guy. I don't have anything else, I don't think. Nope. I got a Milwaukee circular saw, you know, anyway. A corded version of this would be cheaper, I would think, which
yeah.
I'm surprised they're not doing that. And maybe that's somewhere in the plans.
Yeah. But, you know, I was looking at the pricing, and the pricing is fairly on par with what Festool is offering. So
then you got
is it? Oh, yep. their battery powered one.
Yeah.
Like 500 for a battery powered saw. And what's the capacity on it? Is it a.
It's five and a half inches, so it's the same as the Festool, smaller Festool one. Yeah.
Okay.
So a 2-inch depth.
Yeah.
Just under 2 inches, actually. But.
Yeah. So, I think if you're if you're a Bosch guy and you already have a bunch of Bosch stuff, it might make sense for you. But I think if you were looking at just to buy a track saw, you know, I'm thinking I might go Festool, but. That's just me.
I mean, I've heard good things about the DeWalt and Makita ones too. I mean, really. I mean, if you want like good dust collection, I mean, Festool's got it as far as like the complete package.
And I think Makita one was a little cheaper than I'm not sure about the DeWalt, but I believe the Makita one's a little cheaper than the Festool one.
I think so, and it may not be as good at dust collection, and you know, but as far as you know, clamp down track and guide a saw thing. I mean, I've been making those all my adult life when I'm using a saw because, I mean, I used to be decent when I was sheathing roofs, you know, to cut to a line. But anymore, you know, I'm not that good anymore. So I scrap together two pieces of wood and make my own kind of guide thing. But I mean, I love the idea of these things. It's just I've never like really pulled in and gotten one. But $500, and I'm old school. I mean. Rarely am I that far away from, it's funny because I'll talk about this later, but when you're doing like sheet good breakdown with a track saw, how often are you not at the limits of a extension cord, you know, somewhere, you know, say you're within 50 feet of the nearest outlet that gets a lot of work done around your house, you know, shop or otherwise.
Right. They come in handy when you got a break stock down and put it in your hatchback.
Yeah.
Okay. Yes. Yes.
You know,
you could, but for you, Mark, if you were getting a slab, you couldn't use this thing. It only goes 2 inches.
No. Well, so I mean, I have brought my TS50 track saw to a grinding halt in stock before, and so I'm always really leery of cordless tools, that aren't just drills, you know?
Right.
So, but if you're, I mean, if you're just cutting 2x4s and plywood, it seems like it'd do a great job.
Yeah.
But the track is pretty short. I don't imagine you could probably get longer tracks, but
That's one question I had is I know like the Makita and the DeWalt will work on the Festool track, so I wonder if the Bosch will too.
I'm not sure.
Yeah, and that's all.
I need to look into like a 9-foot track, see if I can find an off-brand one. When I'm making, because I made a crate today, and it's a pain to move the keep moving the track along the line.
Yeah. Have you tried those connectors where you can connect them together?
I have, but it takes just as long to do that as it does to move the track. So I never do it. If I just had one long track, as I have the one that came with it, and then I have, I think, like a 6-footer. Because I thought, oh, I can just connect them together. And unless I'm doing a lot of sheet goods, it's not really worth the effort to get that thing out, bolt it together. So, but they do work.
Yep.
You need them.
Well, I have used the Festool. I used to got to borrow one for my book years ago, and I have never had a saw cut that smoothly.
Yes. Really?
Okay.
Unbelievable results. Yeah. And then no dust.
Yeah.
So. Yeah, and I know that's a huge point. I mean, because I work in my basement and I work chiefly with hand tools, but there are times, and if I can control dust, I much prefer that, you know. And I've got the little Dust Deputy cyclonic thing on a bucket with a shop vac, you know, that's about as good as I can get. And then it's on the tool to do better, you know, to have that hookup. And I know Festool, because of the way that thing's built, it's really good at it. I wouldn't suspect that this is terrible. I'd love to see a shootout between them. If they're in that price point, let's see it, you know, everything from performance to dust collection and everything.
That's what concerns me as far as Bosch is offering in this market is, I mean, if you're coming at the same price as the Festool, and
why not
you're
just coming get at the green tool?
Yeah, it's been around for decades, and you know it works.
Right. Yeah. Well, Bosch is a shade of green in Europe, right? Not as blue as it is over here for whatever reason.
Yeah.
Interesting. But anyway, so if you're interested, if you're in the Bosch family of cordless tools, you might want to take a look at it. But, you know, I would I'd recommend you be able to try that sucker out for a while before settling in on buying that, since it's right at the exact same price as Festool's cordless. So
absolutely.
Yeah. Anyway. But moving right along, I found this, and this was new to me. It's probably been out for a while, but it is a mobility kit for Rikon bandsaws. And it fits most of the bandsaws they've made in the last decade, the standard 14-inch bandsaw, which I know is real popular. But this mobility kit puts, looks like two a shaft with two urethane wheels at the back, and then a little flip-up urethane wheel in the front, and so you can move your bandsaw around. Right. And that looks like a much better alternative than the mobile stand I got mine on. So I might pick one of these up.
Well, I know the simple, the one that my dad's got his stuff on, I wonder if you could adapt this to different tools, not just the stands of a bandsaw, but because like his joiner's got you know the four-wheeled wheels on it that you can you jack up one end and you start wheeling around, two of them swivel. This one is a tripod of wheels, the front one just swivels, but it looks good, robust, and it's using the feet or the base of the saw as everything else. You're just clamping these back bracket, front bracket, and that's it, you know. You're not lifting it up onto another frame to do the work. But yeah, I'd be interested if you get one, how you find it.
Yeah, I'm thinking about picking one up because, you know, I do have a mobile base on mine, and I do tend to move my bandsaw around a bit, not a whole bunch, but a little bit. And so, yeah, I'm thinking about picking this up. It looks a lot more stable than mine, but we'll see. But I had the same thought you did. If it works on the bandsaw, is this something I could adapt to other tools? Some respects.
And it's just like how my dad's shop is, the jointer and the planer live separately and get tucked away.
Yeah. So you're going to be restricted to the length of those two, of that back shaft with the two wheels on it, kind of like a tripod effect. So you're going to be restricted to that whatever that length is. But yeah, but you know, I might work for something like a drill press or something like that.
So drill press, that might be a gimme. They're pretty similar, although they mentioned like for these specific models, and this one needs an adapter, a base plate adapter. So yeah, in there.
Yeah, but that's probably just if you don't want to drill holes in steel.
I'm guessing.
Yeah, that's what I'm guessing too. So yeah, I'm thinking about picking one up. So I'll let you know. But I saw that and I go, hey, that, you know, those Rycon 14-inch bandsaws is probably one of the most popular ones out there. And if I didn't know about this kit, I'm sure there's a bunch of people out there that don't know about it either. So anyway, and it's about $90, which is, it's, you know, it's more than a mobile base, but it's not that much more than a decent quality mobile base. So
I'd be interested to see how it sits when in the down position, how stable it is.
Yeah. Because
it looks like the one, the single wheel flips up, but the back one, because it doesn't move, it's got to be in a, just the right spot so that it's only really rollable when it's moving. And otherwise, and maybe that's why that front bracket looks like that, that it's like the foot offset to make it
the same.
Wheels and in the back and feet in the front.
Yeah. Actually. And that mobility kit is very, very similar to what's on my, router table, and it's fine. Because it just has one wheel that flips up at the end, and then you set it back down, so you know, it's got, I guess it's got, you know, the left hand side of the router table is on the wheels and the right hand side is on the floor, and it's perfectly stable and it, you can't move it. So I'm hoping the same, but we'll see. So with that, let's move on to what's in the shop. So, Mark, what have you been working on?
Well, about 5 minutes before we all got together this evening, I put the last screw in a crate for a workbench that's going out the door tomorrow.
Nice. Oh, is that the one you had on Instagram with just the – it didn't have a tail vise on it?
No tail vise, yeah. This is actually the second workbench for the same customer. He's he bought one of my very first workbenches. I did a spec bench with the Lake Erie vise, leg vise, and a Peter Ross planing stop, and it had a Peter Ross hold fast. It was a really nice little bench, and that's the bench that I hauled all over the United States, only to sell to a guy who was like a mile from the shop. And he has since moved to the Dakotas, and he's got a it's a true plate 11, so it has the dovetail tenons in it. He can't get it into his house. So that one's going in the garage, and he needs one that he can put downstairs in the basement so he can work when it's, you know, Dakota cold.
Right.
And so he's got a split top on the way. And I have another bench here that that is the bench for it's my third demo bench for the workbench at home class. And this one will take me through to the last one. We're on week five this week, and the students are, by the end of this week, they'll have their bench up on its legs and be ready to flatten the top for next week. So we're almost done. They're doing really well.
Awesome.
Good.
Yeah, so I'm pretty excited to see that coming together.
So, well, that's fantastic. So this is really working out well then for you.
Yeah, I think I'll...
Or better, should I say, it's working out well for the students.
Yeah. I mean, they don't have to pay to travel. And a lot of the students say they've taken a lot of classes. Some of them have taken several woodworking classes. And the thing they really like about this is there's no frantic pace. It's just do a little bit of work each week like you normally would. And 6 weeks later, you got a workbench.
There you go.
And, you know, if you do a workbench class like we would do here, it's a slog. It's brutal. I mean, you are just working as hard as you can for 7 days straight. So it has me rethinking my in-person class model completely, you know, where the students start with a little bit more of the work done so that they can focus on the finer skills instead of the grunt work. So, the cost would be the same, but the time would be shorter. So they wouldn't have the travel expense, you know, the hotel for a fewer days. And I'm working on that, and I'll definitely do another round of distance at home students in the fall. I'll probably do I'll probably have 10 spots in September.
Oh, okay. Fantastic.
So I'll be, once I get those dates nailed down, I'll be promoting that. So looking forward to it.
Well, fantastic.
Very
so,
cool.
So Sean, what have you been working on?
So over the weekend, it was nice weather and we got outside and we were doing a bunch of cleanup and spring stuff. My wife was transplanting plants, found a yellow jacket wasp queen. While she was moving a plant, unearthed from, you know, they burrow down and kind of hibernate it.
So you're really raising weird. Yellow jackets?
Oh, hell no. No. she chopped it in half, and when I got there, its legs were still twitching, and those legs twitched for about an hour later.
Yeah.
And so then I stepped on it, because its back ass end was off, and yeah. They were like, nope. No, but then
that's the one thing that I've loved when I moved from the Dallas area down here to the Gulf Coast is no wasps. I mean, we have some dirt daubers, but they're harmless. But no yellow jackets, no hornets, no flies. But I don't know. The mosquitoes probably make up the difference.
there you go. There's always something.
I found a yellow jacket nest while I was unhooking a trailer one time. That was fun. I got stung once and I looked around and I was surrounded by yellow jackets and I was like, I'll unhook this later.
Yep.
Ran like hell.
Get out of there. No, but eventually I made my way and it's been on my mind for a while because I built that shed, but the shed is just a box and I did some things to hang a couple tools on one wall, but the other side, the narrow side of it, didn't have anything but a window. And we've got now bee equipment and some other things. I said, yeah, I can make a super simple shelf. So that's what I did. I had just scrap 2x4s, 2x6s, and just happened to have a 16-inch piece of OSB 8 feet long. And I took my sawhorses out there and my old trusty Distin D7, and I cut down the boards, and I did use a little Bosch drill to screw them in. But otherwise, I whipped up a shelf in an afternoon, and now it's much cleaner in there because I've got boxes stacked up above the window, and there's now floor space below to do other things and store other things. So it was just a super duper dumb simple shed shelf, but it was good to get out there, just out in the sun on the grass. This is where I don't need an extension cord to run a saw because I've just got a handsaw, but I can saw to a line, a pencil line that goes inside a shed.
Isn't it nice to break some boards down by hand?
Oh yeah.
You know what I mean? It takes all of 3 minutes longer to cut a 2x4 by hand than it does on a chop saw, but
if
the chop saw is set up and ready to go.
And where I am, you know, that shed is probably 150 feet off my house. And I did, when I was working on it, I strung out every extension cord I had to get power there to run a circular saw when I was actually building it, or my chop saw. But now, yeah, my chop saw's on wheels and it's great. But, you know, either I'm going to do that or I don't, and I leave it up by the house. And then I'm going back and forth every time I got to cut something, and it just complicates things. I carried my sawhorses and my saw and some of the wood I was going to use in one step to just walk out to the back and set it up, laid it down. I had to go back a few times to get some stuff, but it was just go up there, take a measurement, come down, mark, cut. Okay, put up. Yep. Okay, measure it out. Let me see. Okay, cut five of those things real quick. And yeah, I mean, it's way quicker than I would have been to walk to the house and cut it, make that cut. I could just put the saw right on it right there. It's great. I like it.
I like it too. So.
So, Kyle, how about you? What have you been working on?
I've been doing a little steam bending of kiln dried wood. So,
right.
And you've cracked the code now. You know exactly how to do it, right?
I think so. but, you know, I've done general bends in kiln dried wood without much problems. But I actually was doing these bloom back backs, I guess you call them. And anyway, I finally hit the right combination of soaking the wood for at least a week. Then using one of those winch driven bending rigs, and it bent like a charm, not a problem. It was absolutely fantastic. And after I bent it, I left it in the form in the shop kicking around for a couple of days. I put it in my kiln for about 2.5-3 days, and then took it out and let it just kick around the shop till I actually needed that form, which was today. And I took it off and I was like, you got to be kidding me. I mean, there wasn't a, there was a, I mean, it looked absolutely perfect. It was pretty darn almost dead flat too. So that was fantastic. And then, this afternoon I bent another one and, it went fairly well. It would, did not go quite as foolproof as the first one. And I'm wondering if it's because I was, I did this on purpose, is I bent the first one along the tangential plane and I bent the second one along the radial plane just to see what would happen. And, I got it to bend. It should be fine. But I found that both pieces were the same length. But when I was bending it, I found that it was really starting to expand past my stops on my bending strap. And in fact, so much that one of the bows kind of bent below the strap. And I was able to correct it. It looks good. It should work out fine. But that was interesting. I don't know if it's just that particular piece of wood. It shouldn't be because it came from the same exact stock that the other one did. And I wonder if it's bending along the radial plane or this one only soaked for 7 days where the one before soaked for at least 10 days. So, you know, still some stuff to play around with, but I got a few more of these to bend. So I'll
see. Go ahead.
Yeah. So I'll see. I'll see what happens.
when you say you bent it along the radial or the tangential, just to clarify, when you look at the front of the bow, which face is visible?
On the one that I had some difficulty, it would be the tangential plane that would be visible. On the one that wasn't so difficult, it would be the radial plane that was on visible from the front of the bow.
I bet that's the difference.
It could be.
Because
I was real surprised that the strap was like, you know, the strap was acting like it wasn't long enough. I'm going, okay, both of these were exactly the same length. And yeah, so that's what I was thinking. So yeah, it's going to be curious.
When you're shaving, you know, with your draw knife, it's a lot easier to shave that, the radial plane.
The plane, yeah, than it is
the quarter sawn face. So it's a lot easier. It'll delaminate more.
I think I was careful and I didn't get those mixed up, but yeah, that's one of the things. So we got to find out a better term than tangential and radial.
Well, that's chair maker's language, you know, not everybody's chair maker. So,
yeah, but I get confused going, okay, well, what are we talking about again? And yeah.
Yeah. So you're the one that behaved well. You're looking at the quarter sawn face when you look at the front.
Exactly.
Yeah, and that's how, you know, the chairs that I've seen made, that's how they always bend them. So,
yeah, but I've heard people say that, hey, it really didn't make a difference which way you do it. So I figured, okay, let me give it a try. But, you know, two bends does not make a rule. So,
right.
Yeah.
And kiln dried changes the equation quite a bit too.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. So, but being able to kiln dry, bend kiln dried wood around that, I impressed myself. So I was like, yeah, this is actually doable. But yeah, there are steps you have to go through. There is a process, but yeah, I think, the old adage that you can't bend kiln drying wood is, I know it's been proven wrong time and time again, but it's kind of nice when you prove it yourself.
Yeah. Well, and there obviously is steps to take and things to look for, you know, grain to consider, but I think that's not uncommon from any bending procedure. I will say though, your winch driven strap bending mechanism looks way more complicated than I thought that ever had to be. I mean, you're doing a pretty aggressive bend. I get it, but
yeah,
having seen, like, you know, chairmaker shops steam bending with a form and pegs and clamps, you know, around a call, like, that seems to work. Yours is a cool, like, one man, you know, operation.
Those chair makers have trees.
True. Yeah.
That's the difference. I mean, okay. That really is it. I mean, it's
they're dealing with green wood.
That green wood to that is just that much different.
Yeah, you can eliminate so many tools and problems and
You don't need, you know, some of those, especially the bends I was doing, those are normally not done with a strap. You just grab it and bend it. I mean, you know, but you know, you do that with the wood I'm working with, cause that's, you know, I started from that process. You grab it, you bend it, and you hear this crack.
Yeah. Nope. Not fun.
Yeah. So, So yeah, so but this works, and you know, it was fun working through the process. Mm-hmm. And yeah. So, and then the other thing is, finally, I'm getting back to the rocker. So, so I've been working on that a little bit. I got the two armrests almost fully shaped and done. I still need to do a little bit more work on them, but they're almost done. And so next, I just need to carve the seat and put it together. So that should only take me another year. at the rate I'm going,
give or take, yeah, you know, it's all right, you got time.
Yeah, but you know, I take I how many chairs? I got like 6 chairs in progress. It's ridiculous. But anyway,
little bites, you'll get through it.
Yeah, a little bite. Well, you know, most of this stuff is like demo stuff for my jigs, and it's just like, okay, I need another seat blank, and you know, I'm like, I need to at least assemble these into chairs eventually. So anyway, but with that, so Gary, what are you working on in the shop?
I was working on a hand plane, actually, making a wooden hand plane.
Oh, making one. Okay.
And I was discovering that metallurgy is as hard to understand as steam bending kiln dried wood.
Really? So are you like forging or
yeah, heat treating. You
know, heat treating. Okay.
You're heat treating.
Yeah. So I buy blade stock.
Right.
And I've been doing this for years. I buy blade stock. It's 01 tool steel. It comes annealed, so it's soft. And you cut it, you shape it, put a little bit of a bevel on it, not the full grind, because the blade tends to warp a little bit. And then I take it outside, take my propane torch to it, heat it till it's cherry red, and here's the great thing, loses magnetism. What? Right. Yeah, but when it loses magnetism.
Yeah. Okay. I've heard about that. Yeah, that's pretty cool, though.
Austenite becomes magnetite or something like that. There's names for the different arrangement of molecules of the steel. And once you get it that hot, then you quench it in your oil. I use an olive oil from a northern slope in Italy. It has
only the finest blade olive oil.
Yeah. The olive trees are grown above 5,000 feet. Yeah. I know the place you're talking about. Yeah.
Exactly.
It's Arabica olive oil. Yeah.
Very special. Anyway, and then I take the blade and dip it in that. Swish it around, and I did that with this blade. It was the end of a bar, 18-inch bar of this stuff, 1/8 inch thick, 1 inch wide, 01. I hardened it, I tempered it, and my tempering process is to take it home, turn on the oven to 400 degrees, and stick it in there. I stuck it in for 70 minutes, 1 hour 10, because I've had some problems with the edges kind of rolling over. I thought, well, let's just make sure it's good and tempered. I could not keep an edge on this blade. I tried regrinding it. I was getting no sparks. It's like, that's weird. Mm-hmm. So I have a student who's working in the shop these days, and I said, we shut out all the lights. I said, look at my spark pattern on an old Stanley chisel, on another blade that I've hardened and tempered, and on this blade that I just tempered. And it felt like it was too hard. So
the other blades you made from the stock were fine, just this one piece in the end?
Yes, just this one section. Uh-huh. So I called a student of mine, who was a mastery student 15 years ago, who's a machinist. And I said, Nate, what am I doing wrong? He says, you're doing everything the way you normally do everything. It's a bad piece of steel. Get rid of it.
It's like there's no carbon in it or something.
I was like, what? That doesn't make sense. So I retempered it, but just by hand now, with my torch, thinking, okay, it's too hard. Let's just temper it. I took it outside and could see this color change. It got pretty toasty brown. And then I let it cool, and I tried it again, and the edge just crumbled like I was trying to cut concrete with it. Mm. So, I'm like, is it too hard or is it too soft? So, because it's my last piece of steel, I said, I'm going to try this again. Took it outside, did the hardening process, brought it in here, didn't temper it at all, and was working on the blade. And I thought, well, let's just grind it and flatten the back and see if it'll cut. Cuts like a dream. Hmm. Untempered. I don't get it. So, and a good spark pattern. So it's acting like a normal blade. I don't know what's going on. So, come and take classes with me.
Yeah, right.
I got all the answers.
And without that, so I went through a metallurgy class in my college classes, somewhere in mechanical engineering, and the whole Austin Titan and all that good stuff. You know, the difference between air quenching and oil quenching and tempering. The pattern of it all. I mean, it is. It's black magic, right?
It really is.
And that's crazy. And without like an electron microscope to actually see what you're producing, you're doing the color. I've seen straw in my day, and I've seen straw heat, heated metal that straw color, and it doesn't look the same to me. So you have to have the eye for it. You have to know it, unless you've got like all the tools.
Yeah.
And I went to a commercial shop that does, the work for the auto industries, and they're like cutting and then forging and then heating and whatever, tempering and all this other stuff for all their different things. And to see how they can tweak this one value and just make that just right for that application.
Right. I
mean, these aren't tools, and that's a whole other thing where you're trying to get the grain structure of an edge. I mean, that's where it comes down. And why can't I think of his name? The Perfect Edge, the book.
Ron Hawk.
Ron Hawk, yeah, he goes into good detail about grain structure, and what it takes to make. I mean, the fact that you may not have the right crystal type in that edge to ever meet and hold an edge, and just on a microscopic level, you'd be able to see it. But yes, those grains are too big or misaligned in a way that they just fall down.
And what Nate the machinist said to me was, maybe it was just a bad piece of steel, or it's the end of a run, or maybe it's just the end of that particular bar of steel that didn't get something.
Something.
Yeah, it didn't get processed correctly. And you might have reprocessed it.
And so I'm getting it seems that without the tempering, I'm able to get an edge that's holding. I don't have the plane made yet, so we'll see. But I'm able to cut end grain with it nicely. Yeah. And the edge doesn't crumble like a cookie. And so I'm making progress. I'm learning as I go. It's so fun. It's so fascinating to be rediscovering stuff that's only been around for 3,000 or 4,000 years. It's just.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. It's, well, it's, you know.
Same like steam bending.
Exactly. I mean,
been around doing it forever, right?
Since they started making boats.
Yeah.
Pretty interesting.
Yeah, but you can watch everyone do it, but until you actually do it.
I think the soaking it in water makes a big difference.
Oh yeah, that was a big
makes
thing.
Makes a big difference. Yeah, that's the first thing we do. The same student, I said, okay, let's get started on your bending project. Cut your piece, get it in the water, and we're gonna make a new bending strap. Get a little more leverage on it. I don't know if you saw that article with Brian Boggs in Fine Woodworking a couple issues ago, but I mean he's a mechanical genius, as far as I'm concerned, and his bending straps have gotten bigger, and that's what I think it takes. If you don't have that winch, which I don't, have a inch.
I have the winch, but no, I haven't seen the article yet. I need to go back. Well, probably one of my biggest issues I've had with fine woodworking is I signed up for their digital plan, and I don't get the print magazine anymore. Mm-hmm. And I never read the magazine anymore because I don't get the print version. So I need to step up my game. Cause I go, oh, I'll just read on my iPad and stuff comes up and I never get around to it.
Well, reading on an iPad is not the same. You need the
magazine.
It's great to have the online edition when you have something very specific you want to look up, but that's why I pay for it. But other than that, I want the
I should have put this in the woodworking news and I totally forgot about it, but I did notice that Fine Woodworking now with their ultimate plan or whatever it is where you get the digital stuff as well as a print magazine as well as da 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 da. Now they're making all their plans available if you sign up for that plan. So that's kind of cool.
Yeah. There you go.
But so Gary, so besides delving into the mysteries of metallurgy, what else is going on at the Northwest Woodworking Studio?
Well,
I guess before we get to that, for those that are new to the podcast, I refer you to our previous episodes with Gary. But in case you don't want to go back that far, can you give us a little rundown on the Northwest Woodworking Studio?
Sure. Yeah. Be happy to. Well, we're here in Portland, just across from downtown. Everyone's safe. We're all right. it's a 5,000 square foot building, but when COVID hit a year ago, basically all our classes shut down. And there's still limitations on the classes. And then I imposed my own limitations on how much face-to-face contact I wanted to have with different groups of strangers every other week or something. So I have kept some basic classes running, in-person classes running, but switched.
How long have you been there?
Oh, the studio has been running 24 years.
Wow.
Yeah, 24 years. But we're going.
That's amazing, and you're only like 35 years old.
Start them young.
Yes, thank you very much. I've been around for a while. So the transition, though, to online classes has been just amazing. The response has been terrific. Thanks in part to, chatting with folks like you and your podcast and getting the word out. Yeah, we've increased by a factor of 6 our mastery students. Now, that's increased my workload quite a bit. Mm-hmm. And I promised everyone I would call everyone up on the phone and chat with them. And that's been work trying to coordinate that. But all in all, it's been a great transition for me. Great. And
so this has actually given you a whole new opportunity to teach woodworking to even more students and, share your knowledge out there.
Well, I thought I was doing a pretty good job before.
Mm-hmm.
But because of the format, there's less work at the bench for the students. It's hard for me to see what they're doing unless they've got a good camera setup, and most folks just use their laptop and they walk away. I say, all right, so go ahead and cut some dovetails. And then they walk away and I'm looking at their ceiling. I'm like, you're doing a great job, I think. I'm spending, we get together for about 2.5-3 hours each week. And I'm spending 2/3 of that time talking or showing a video that I've already done and already produced on a particular topic. So it's making me up my game as far as history of furniture, history of design, and that's been a blast. Because the internet is great. Hey, let's get pictures of Emile Jacques Ruhlman. There you go, man. It's just one after another you can download, and it's great to share that stuff with people who never heard of Reimer Schmidt and his chair. Mm. That's a lot of fun. So it's different, but it's been good. And I'm trying to figure out how to do another run come October with a new group of students. I think I'm going to cut down the number a little bit of students. Mm-hmm. I've got 18 in one group, and that's a bit.
Yeah, I can imagine. Yeah.
What's the maximum you would do in person? Sorry, Mark.
Oh, in person?
Yeah.
In the mastery program, I'd stop it at 8.
Yeah. Mm. See, that's the danger. I mean, not danger, but that's one of those things. Like, virtually, you can open it up way more accessible to a lot more people. But yeah, now you're stretched even thinner than you would in person because, they're not all physically there. And so, it's just one of those things. Like,
what I'm trying is, coming up April 17th, I'm starting a new class.
Yeah,
called a build along session, and so I'm trying to address that problem of how do I get enough people to make it worthwhile for me to run the class, but also get them access to me. So.
Right.
The way I set it up, it's a pretty simple project. It's a coffee table I've done before. It's a nice design, but pretty simple.
Mm-hmm.
I'll show hand methods. I'll show router methods for cutting the mortises. Talk about, lumber selection and a little bit about milling. But everyone's doing that at their shop. And they have 2 weeks until the next class. But in that intervening week, so we do classes on Saturday. The next Saturday is Q&A. And so for an hour, it's just, do you have questions? Let's talk. And so I'm hoping that people will open up and be brave enough to ask questions. I have one group that I have now, and I complain to my sweetie. I just say, they don't talk. I think some of them can't speak. I don't. Not sure. They're so quiet. Do you have any questions? Silence. But then one of them teaches art history at a college, and he has 40 or 50 students in a class. And he said, well, at least the students in your class keep their cameras on.
Yeah.
Can you imagine talking to 40 people and not seeing any of them?
Yeah. I'll tell you, my kids doing virtual school, there were times when they were here, I'd walk upstairs and go, what are you doing? And they're like chilled back in a chair. I'm like, yeah, my camera's not in it anyway. They don't have to look at me.
Right.
I'm like, really? How is a teacher communicating with you then? It's essentially a one-way road then. It's not effective. It's really
tough. Yeah. At first, when I started this we started doing online lectures last July, and it was killing me because everyone was on mute. I'm cracking good jokes. They're deaf. They're just not responding. I'm like, I'm dying here. I'm dying. Is this mic on? You know, that sort of stuff. It's just, you don't get that response. You don't get that feedback that you're doing things well or people are getting it. So you are sort of flying blind. All that being said, I'm reaching a larger group of students in a really strange time. So I'm learning to adjust.
I think that's most of it. You got to learn the medium and how to do that. Yeah. So
Gary, one of the things I did with my students is if it's a lecture, it's pre-recorded and they watch it on their own time. And then when we get together, we're just talking. It's all, if I'm going to make them come and sit down with me, it's all interactive.
Yeah.
And I start out my conversations with, okay, what can I do? You know, like what can be better? I let them critique my work.
Oh yeah.
And that gets them started. And then that rolls into, well, I got this question about this one thing. And, and I found that to be really helpful.
Yeah, that was the purpose of my phone calls with everyone, is to try and get feedback. What can I do better, and what do we need to do? I hear you, and I've been doing a lot more pre-recorded lectures.
Yeah.
Which is really great from a teaching standpoint, because what you see is me chilling out at my bench, and kick back, and acting like a student. But it's so easy, right? When you've already pre-recorded it, it's so easy.
Yeah, yeah, you can reuse it, and the time with the students is unique.
Yeah, you know? So we're working out the kinks, but the hardest thing so far has been the critiques. So my approach to this is that we're building 9 projects over 2 years. I choose the piece, they do the design work. So we did a dovetail box. Okay, it can be as big or as small as you want. I don't care. I just want hand-cut dovetails, a frame and panel lid, and butt hinged lid. So those are my lectures, and we try and address those issues and what they're going to run into. But the designs are theirs, and you get some amazing stuff. Just stuff like what one of my students said, boy, I never would have thought of some of the stuff I saw. I never would have thought of it. And me too. So there's been some amazing work and some nice work and some work where people are struggling with the design side of things, but you got to do that. Any designer knows, Brian Boggs told me once, he said, if you're not throwing away designs, you're not designing. It's just a constant struggle and process of failure and saying, okay, you're not a complete idiot. You're mostly an idiot, but not a complete idiot. Try it again. Try it differently. You can do this. And so I tell my students, when I start designing, the first 20 minutes, I'm sitting there and it's designing with a big felt tip pen or a carpenter's pencil. No precision, just ideas, just spitting out ideas. The first 20 minutes, I am in a constant battle with myself saying, God, you suck at this. You should stop now. Don't do anymore. You're embarrassing yourself. And then something happens, like this switch turns after about 20 or 30 minutes. And all of a sudden I go, oh, I have some interesting ideas here. Let me riff off this. Let me try this. And it's a process. And it's switching over to that right brain activity of design is not easy. But that's what I'm trying to teach these guys about, as well as technique. And so that's that's what's so much fun about this program. I'm happy it's blossomed this way.
Well, that's great. So So this new build along session is going to be kind of like that in a nutshell.
I hope, you know, the design stuff, I one student wrote and said, hey, I want to change the proportions on this piece. I said, great. Terrific. Mm-hmm. You don't have to do this design. I'm going to, you know, actually the plans that I sent out to folks show three different leg shapes and, you know, you can do different things with it. It's a little coffee table, and we don't have time to go through edge laminating, flattening, hand planes, sharpening. We just don't. Right. So when I first built this table, and it was a production piece for me, and I was putting it in galleries, I was doing split tops, two boards, and then running a pattern through them or butterfly keys. So a pattern that cloud rise pattern, only, you know, just one side of it. But both boards had that cut into the edge. It's just just a really simple design idea. But that's going to be our final class, is talking about some of those options. And there's a ton of them. And you can do butterfly keys, and you can do this and that. But
in there, this course, there's a lot of freedom for the students to design their own project, so to speak, within certain parameters.
Absolutely. Yeah, I'm not trying to have people all end up with the same piece, and they can choose their material. And you know, there's a lot of conversation to be had about riffs on stock versus flats on stock, you know, quarters on stock, all that stuff that makes a difference in how your piece ends up looking. You know, you have a really important decision as a designer by your choice of wood. You know, you build a piece out of ash, or you build it out of maple, and it's a completely different piece. Yeah, the form might be the same, but it's a different piece. And so your lumber choice and how you rough mill it, and all that influences the piece. And it's simple stuff. It really is simple stuff. It's just stuff that people haven't thought about. And you're talking about your bending issue, and, you know, are you bending along the quartesson face or the flatsawn face? And, you know, it makes a difference. But it makes a difference because of grain run out, not so much for looks. It makes a difference whether you've got straight grain pieces. And so,
right,
for our purposes, we're not doing cabriole legs. We do that in the mastery program, but a cabriole leg that's done in flatsawn stock, whew, oh yeah, that's a loud leg. That's a
I've that's seen those before. Going, yeah.
Hey, look at me, look. And if you do it nice,
it's like the folks that do the green and green stuff, and let's put every green and green motif into this one piece.
Right. Oh, right. Yeah. I designed a piece one time for a church. This was a few years ago. And the builder said, I want to build the altar. That's my deal with the church. I build the altar. So I designed this piece, and I designed it out of 6x6 fir posts, because they had harvested some fir from their site and used it inside the church and stuff. And this guy went ahead and veneered the flats on side. I couldn't get riff stock in 6x6.
Yeah.
And so I was happy to just show the quarter sawn face and the flat sawn face, and he veneered it. I was so mad. I was like, what are you doing, man? You can't, I mean, it's not going to survive, and it's not real. It's not real. And you see that sometimes with, particularly with arts and crafts piece, where there's four quarter sawn face it.
Right. And you go, exactly.
Wait a second here. So, you know, that sort of stuff is pretty interesting.
Yeah. I saw some article years and years ago about, they're doing some arts and crafts piece, and they were you know, bisecting this leg a couple of different times to get the quarter sawn face on all four sides. And I went,
No, I think I may have seen the same article, and they basically build a post.
Yeah.
Like, tongue and groove together. Yeah. So it was all showing four quarter sawn faces. And I'm like,
yeah.
Okay. But that's like stickly gluing on the ends of their tenons to the outside.
Exactly. Yeah.
And I was like, okay, yeah, it's, you know, it's giving you the idea of it, but it's not real.
Yeah.
So I think there's some virtue in reality.
Exactly. Exactly. So. Well, to get back to the course there, the build along session. So you said there's, what's the skill level and tooling requirements?
I think it's beyond beginners.
Yeah.
I mean, I've taught this particular table design to my high school students when I had my nonprofit and we were mentoring high school kids. Mm-hmm. And so it was, you know, for seriously ADD kids that some of them were, it was really successful. So there's four mortise and tenon joints and then options for how we're putting those two leg assemblies together. Mine is done with a sliding dovetail, but you could do a slot and a long screw. We've got different ways of working that out. So it's pretty straightforward. There's not a lot of tricky joinery. So, intermediate level, but beyond beginner is what I say.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Well, that's good. So, so is this class full yet, or you still got some?
Oh, golly, no. No, I've got...
Okay.
I've got... If I get to 15, that'd be great, but I'm halfway there. Yeah, I'm halfway there. I could use folks. Come on down.
Fantastic. It'd be fun.
It's on Saturday mornings.
Yeah.
Late
and the
Saturday.
The first one starts
April 17th.
April 17th. So, so you'll be hearing this. So if you're interested in it, get on it right away.
Yeah. So it's 11 o'clock West Coast time, so afternoon. Yeah. But, 2 hours. It's going to be fun. We're going to have fun with it. But there's no point in doing it if you're not having fun with it.
Exactly.
So, I'm looking at my drawings. And I'm having a student transfer those to a SketchUp.
Oh, okay.
As well.
Cool. Very cool.
Fantastic. So it should be accessible to everyone to look at the plans and say, okay, what do I want to change? What do I,
you know. Just wanted to build it as you have it, that's perfectly all right too.
Oh yeah, sure.
Yeah,
absolutely. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. So now, for folks who want to sign up, go to northwestwoodworking.com.
Yeah.
And just look for the build along session. I think it's right
online
there.
Online learning. Yeah.
Yeah.
Online instruction. Yeah.
Yeah.
So it's a different kind of world. I gotta say, you know, you get on the internet and you're cruising along and I'm, you know, on YouTube watching some stupid movie or something. And, and then you see, some woodworker and just, you know, 500,000 views and you go, why? I don't, and then you got to check it out. Right. You got to see, well, okay, right. I'll be 500,001 and see. And actually this guy I checked out was building a workbench and he had some interesting thoughts. But, you know, a lot of times there's so much to share. There's so much information to share. And the internet just kind of glosses over it and says, oh, yeah, you just do this. Don't worry about the grain and don't worry about this. But there's so much to talk about. It's such a deep pool that we dive into. And so often people who come into this stuff say, oh, well, yeah, I just want to take a class so I can learn how to build this. I want to build a chair. Boy, you got a couple of years before you're going to build a chair. If you want to do it.
Yeah.
You know, you want to do it right, you want to do a good job, nice design, and comfortable, it takes time.
Yeah, that's a big part, the comfy part, yeah. A lot of people can build a chair, but can you build a comfortable chair?
Oh, I built, but yeah, my first chair was screwed together, fir and cedar, and was brute, it was terrible. But, you know, that's how you learn.
Exactly,
Anyway, there's...
There's a lot to say for, you know, just watching someone do it and actually participating in something like a course or a class and actually getting, like you said, getting some feedback from an instructor, getting some, you know, one-on-one or at least some preferential attention from someone that knows what they're doing and not just, you know, someone who's out there, you know, trying to get more views than the other person.
Yeah. And that's what it's about. And you, and people say, well, how does he get paid? Trust me, he's getting paid. Mm-hmm. YouTube pays him. We don't know how, but he's getting paid by the view. So, but as Mark points out, and when people have the opportunity to go, oh, well, yeah, that reminds me, I do have a question. That's so valuable. Just to be able to say, I don't get this. So explain it again, or I get it, but it's not working. So one of my master's students was in a snit this weekend and was going, my leg assemblies are all crooked. Okay. Well, recut the mortise. Glue something onto the tenon, recut it, figure out what you did wrong and do it right this time. So, I didn't tell him that, yeah, it just happens, and because that's sort of demoralizing. But it's happened to me, and I don't know what I did wrong. I'm doing everything the way I normally do everything, and all of a sudden my rail on, you know, is sort of up there in space. And so, you know, it's, I have come up with my third rule. I think I've told you my first two rules of woodworking.
Yes, yes, you have. But for our listeners, go ahead and repeat them.
I have now three rules. Here are my first two. My first two rules are, number one, wood moves. You can pay attention to this. Brian Boggs, when he builds his chairs, he would make sure that he was getting veneer logs that the veneer mills weren't using, and cutting out his legs so that at each corner they mimicked the growth rings of the tree. So it was all rifts on, but they were all pointed in towards the center of the tree. Just like the tree grew, that's how his chair was built. Wood moves. He understood this. Now, if you're an 18th century furniture guy, you have a high boy with 24-inch wide sides, and you glue those into a post, and it splits. But they agree that wood moves. All right. Number two, the other woodworkers, they don't know what they're talking about. There you go. And that, I thought, covered all the you know, scenarios. But what were we doing? Oh, I think Adam was working on this desk project, and he had tried and, you know, run through all the permutations and got all the clamps, and things changed. No, it wasn't him. It was me. I was gluing something. I forgot. I was gluing something up, and it was this bookcase I was working on, and in the middle of gluing up, I broke a panel, one of the side panels that I was gluing on, and I'd already glued on the first side panel. Taken my time, added the wedges, everything was fine. The other side was on dry. And then I went away, came back 3 hours later, knocked off the dry side, and went to glue that on. And it snapped on me. And I'm in the middle of a glue up. What do? You can't stop. It's tight bond. There's a clock ticking. So I was using colorful language to help the pieces get together, and I had to power through it. And afterwards, I told Adam, number three, glue changes everything. It's the truth. You can practice a glue up six times, and you have everything. It goes together the same way each time. Seventh time, you use the glue, and it doesn't go together right. Mm-hmm. So that's my third rule. Glue changes everything.
Glue changes it all.
It really does.
Yeah. So I have a rule. If you're absolutely got a mallet in your hand and you're wailing on a piece, you've already ruined it.
Yeah.
I was just tapping this piece. I think part of the problem was that I dropped this piece once. It fell off my bench. So I kept adding butterfly keys to it, but I kept splitting in new spots. So it's fine now, but I can't, you know, I had to keep it for myself.
Yeah,
a reminder piece.
If you think you're hitting it too hard, you are, and you've already ruined it. Is that basically it?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah. I did that a few years ago, and went, okay.
Yeah,
Yeah. So, and luckily I didn't catastrophically ruin it, but it was like, okay, I need to cut all this stuff a little shorter to take the dents from the hammer out.
Oh, no.
Mallet out. You know?
Well, hey. a few years ago, I hadn't known about them. I got a dead blow mallet, mm-hmm. and that changed my life because that don't leave a mark.
Mm-hmm.
It's great for putting things together, but especially for taking them apart instead of trying to get a piece of scrap in your hammer. And they're great. I did have, I never knew though that Roy Underhill came out to the studio, 10 years ago. And they built a foot treadle lathe, which I still have. Anyone interested in that foot treadle lathe, you give me a hug. And they made it out of southern yellow pine. Now, if anyone has had the joy of working with that softwood, you'll realize how damn hard it is. It's so hard.
And that's all we have in this area. I mean, I go to my Lowe's and Home Depot. Uh-huh, that's all it is southern yellow pine. So, I always get all kinds of 2x4s and 2x8s and 2x12s, and I just store it in there, let that construction lumber dry out. And all my shop furniture is built out of it. Yeah.
Yeah. I believe it.
Yeah. It's hard. And then, especially after a couple of years, it's even harder.
Oh. We can't get it here. To special order it.
Really?
Yeah. Or drive it across the state.
We would use that when I was building houses. We'd get southern yellow only in like stair tread pieces, like for the horses, for stairs.
Yeah. Yeah. Scaffolding and stuff. Yeah.
Well, no, I mean, like we cut the wedges out of it to make a stairway, it would be the tread or the riser, but it would be the horses that hold those two things. And, actually I think that's what I made mine out of. I redid my stairs in my house, not long after we moved in. And, and because of that, it's super hard. It's super dense. It's usually wet. We get it up here. It's pretty sappy, and, but I've seen other people do benches out of them. And I agree. Like I can't imagine working that stuff in that way. To get it to stick together, it's just that's going to be a heavy pain in the butt.
When I built my shave horse many years ago, I decided, I made the whole thing out of southern yellow pine, 2x4s, 2x8s. Like I said, I went, well, I'll just glue up some blanks and make the seat out of that and carve that. I eventually did it, but yeah.
Mm-hmm. Well, I have a story.
Oh, I imagine.
Roy Underhill comes out here to build this foot treadle lathe, right?
Yeah.
And I go to the lumberyard and I find all this 2x12 southern yellow pine. And I get enough for the class. And then I go back and buy up all the rest of it because you never see it out here on the West Coast. Never see it. And Roy's students were cutting these mortises and they destroyed my dead blow mallets. Can you imagine what it takes to destroy a dead boy beating on a chisel? And
shots like coming out of the sides of it. I can imagine.
I never saw a shot, but the all that black rubber casing that was just blown off the
man.
Yeah, I'm serious abuse of these dead blow mallets. Man, that's some seriously hard stuff. So, but I bet it's pretty once it's aged. I guess.
There's a bad old timey piping design thing. It's the industry I work in or have worked in just previously. It's beat to fit and paint to match. And it seems like that idea might have been in there somewhere.
Well, there's this historic Galveston's full of these historic Victorian houses and they're very stately mansions and stuff. And there's one called Ashton Villa. And inside the villa, you look at all the drawing rooms and all that stuff and everything's in walnut and it's absolutely finely carved. And the proctor actually says, I think that's the right word, or probably not. What's the word docent. I'm looking for?
Docent.
Docent, yeah. The docent, it's leading us through and says, actually, the most valuable stuff is in the servants' quarters. And we walk in there, and it's long-leaf, curly, southern yellow pine.
Wow.
Yeah. He goes, you just can't find that stuff anywhere. He goes, that's the most valuable wood in the whole place is what's in the servants' quarters.
Wow. Yeah. Yeah, it was just junk back then. Right.
Yeah.
Right? Well, it's like the walnut barns of the Ozarks.
Yeah.
Out here, when I was looking for a building to buy back in the early aughts, I saw a building with a ceiling and a roof made of 2x12s stacked on edge.
Hmm.
Yes, not flat, on edge.
On edge.
Inch and a half, inch and a half, inch and a half, inch, just, you know, a forest to make this roof.
Yeah.
Because there was nothing but wood out here at that time. So, yeah.
Wow.
This will be good. God.
Wow. Mm.
Yeah, people had a different attitude about material then.
Mm-hmm.
So can I ask a question? What's the price of a sheet of OSB in your neck of the woods?
$40 for a 7/16.
Unbelievable.
Yeah.
This is unbelievable. If any politician is listening, give me a call.
Oh, it's not even politics. I mean,
it's doubled.
It's mm-hmm. well, it's more than doubled.
It's doubled. I used to pay 18, I think.
I mean, used to pay $5, $7 a sheet.
$5 for a sheet.
Yeah. $4 or $5. Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, it's, at the right time. Post 9/11, it went crazy, and it was like $8, $9 a shot. Yeah. A sheet. You know, that was wild. This is the housing market's a buyer's market, and everyone else is stuck at home and improving their home. We actually were talking about, in addition, we talked to a builder, and he told us, he said, right now, you're thinking about adding a garage. We right now are somewhere in $110, $120 a square foot for a garage.
Wow.
I said, that is a hollow shell.
Right.
And our garage is 600 square feet. That's a $65,000 garage.
Nice garage, though. That's a nice.
No. No, it's not.
It's just an empty shell.
It's big, but that's an empty ass shell. I mean, it's just the fact that, a sheet of OSB going for $40, that drives everything up the roof, man. And that's insane.
It is insane.
I mean, I built that shelf in my shed, and my wife actually made a joke that, like, this stuff is gold. You shouldn't use it for this. I'm like, it's scrap. It's at home. It's in the garage. But when I bought it 5-6 years ago for whatever the hell project I was using for, I paid, less than $10 for it, for sure.
Yeah.
The southern yellow pine I talked about, it's more than doubled in price.
Yeah.
So has the plywood.
But it's a high supply and the demand isn't high demand and low supply.
What's interesting is plywood in the Home Depot has also gone way up,
mm-hmm.
as well as OSB. But if I go to my hardwood supplier and I want some, because some of my jigs, I use the Baltic birch. Baltic birch has gone up in price by $5.
Okay.
Which is kind of interesting.
I think it just
maybe depends. I should be looking at Baltic birch for my crates.
Maybe.
Honestly, it might have come down to a reasonable spot compared.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, I was paying $45 for one of the 3/4 by 5 by 5 sheets, and it was $48.
And that's some cabinet grade.
Yeah. It's like $3 more.
One of my students was going to sheathe the inside of his shop with OSB, and then he found out that birch plywood was cheaper.
Yeah. My gosh. Yeah.
That's nuts. But he used birch plywood because it was.
I mean, when I did my shop, mine's all in OSB. I painted it white, but it's all OSB. But it was $5-6 a sheet.
Mm-hmm.
And I was buying the thicker stuff. I forget what size, but they got the thin ones and the one that's a little thicker. And I'm 7/16 or something like that,
I've seen everything OSB, CDX. It's all up.
Yeah,
it's just wild.
It's all metric too, because
Well, anyway, sorry to bring up such a.
Well, no. I think that's.
Well, I appreciate
times we live in.
Yeah. I'm going to be calling on my supplier for Baltic birch tomorrow.
At least get pricing.
I can buy Baltic birch 1/4-inch thick to build a crate. It just needs to hold a screw.
Right.
And OSB is really good at that, but you can't get it any thinner than 7/16. At least not at the lumber store. So. It'll drop the weight down, and maybe save some costs. So I hadn't thought about doing that. So yeah. I just been just astounded at, I mean, I spent $120 on materials for a crate.
Yeah.
You know, and it used to be $50. So, yeah.
Well, you know, you got to stop hand cutting your dovetails for your crates. I mean,
I put about $20 worth of screws in there too. So, but I figure, you know, you're putting a workbench in a crate. You really can't build it too strong. You know, you don't have time to make another one.
Right.
You know, so I'd rather spend the extra money in an hour or two on the crate. So, because you can't get an insurance claim on a freight. I mean, good luck with that.
Mm.
Well, before we let you go, Gary, so how is the podcast going?
Podcast has been really fun.
I love listening to them. They're like short little bites. So it's
yeah.
We're the long form of the long form podcast. Of what we're doing, but
I was listening to something or down one wormhole on the web, and I found some guy talking about urban design, and I was listening to him, and they said that
this a guy that's majorly into biking?
Well, I don't know that.
Okay, maybe not. There's this urban design guy that's always talking about building urban spaces that are bike accessible. So I was wondering if he's the same guy.
I don't know.
Fairly popular. Anyway,
I'm trying to remember what the subject.
He was like a Danish or Swedish guy, but he talked with a flawless accent. You couldn't even tell. But anyway,
could be. I'm trying to remember the subject that he was speaking on.
Yeah.
But that's not coming up. What's coming up is that they described him as a podcaster with one of the most successful podcasts ever, and they were 4 minutes long on average. And I thought, oh, now this guy's smart. I don't know.
Might be that. His podcasts are short, but they're not that short. Well, anyway,
I'll see if I can find it.
Yeah, he's an architecture. So,
the podcasts are going great. There's still so much to learn about him. And I have a spot on, is it Ko-fi or Ko-fi? You tell me. I don't know. I think it's Ko-fi, but
I'd go with Ko-fi. Yeah.
Yeah, people can support me there, and then every once in a while, someone will drop something in the bucket, and I'll go, "Wow, okay, great." I'll keep playing. So. Yeah, it's fun. People respond to it, and that's, you know, it's just, I forget. Oh, well, yeah, last podcast was about oysters, because one of the guys who comes into the shop here sells a lot of tools and knickknacks and stuff, and he was selling something to a guy who worked and has an oyster farm on the coast, and he brought him a bushel basket full of oysters. Well, the clock's ticking.
Let's get into these. Yeah.
Yeah. And so he gave me a bucket full of them, and I gave away half my bucket to someone else, and I'd never shucked my own oysters. So there was this opportunity, and, you know, I had prepared a dish with crushed ice and lemon wedges and made a little vinegar, and I ate dinner at the sink because I was having so much fun busting these things open with my screwdriver and just slipping them down. It was so much fun. So that chat was about opportunity, and I'd never shucked my own oysters. I'd enjoyed them, but I'd never shucked my own. So there's a little bit to learn there. Anyway, it was fun.
Yeah, there is. Too bad you can't get the great Gulf Coast oysters that we have. But anyway.
Neatarts Bay, man. Neatarts Bay, pretty nice. They're not huge. They're not going to choke you as they slide down. They are tasty, I got to say.
No. The Pacific does have some great – everybody has great oysters.
Oysters are terrific.
Yeah, they're absolutely.
They are a big hump to get past if you've never had one.
There is. There's this the place near me that was voted, I think, in one of the national magazines as the best dive – seafood bar, but it's actually great. It's called Gilhooey's, but they do fresh oysters, you know, by the dozen, by the half dozen, whatever you want. But they do have this oysters Gilhooey, which is actually on a open fire grilled oysters, and they put some lemon butter and Parmesan on them, and they are fantastic.
Those are the oysters I can eat right there. That sounds great. Mm-hmm. I'm not slurping them down raw. I just can't do it.
Sean, were your parents, did they speak Polish?
No, very limited. They can probably speak more than that. I know how to, you know, sing happy birthday and you know, nozdrovia to you know, toast. But no, not conversational.
Nozdrovia. I don't know why that's common. That's
I think that is
in Slavic and
It is pretty common.
Yeah. And then happy birthday is stola najivina, I think.
I don't know much Polish myself, but
it's wild. I don't know why that is. I mean, I'm like third generation, I think. Yeah. I mean, it's not that far off the boat, you know, right. And it just didn't carry through. Yeah. But I think my grandpa who's still alive, I think he knows a little more than my mom, and then me and
ask him if he's ever eaten chanina.
I've had chanina.
Oh, you have?
Yeah.
And you don't like oysters and you can eat that stuff?
No, I mean, it's like, yeah, I mean, everything's, I'm not averse to oysters. You know, it's something, you know, Mark doesn't want to slurp them, but I ate sushi.
Soup.
Yeah. Duck's blood soup. Yep. Yeah. I had a friend of mine who's, we went to like his aunt's house and she made that for us. It's exactly what it sounds like. It's deep and it's thick. It's salty. It's just, yeah. And that and what's, you know, the common term is city chicken, which in back in the streets of you know, immigrant nation, it was, you know, just frats on spikes, you know, grilled.
Yeah.
You know, it's just, but we're industrious people, man. We make it work.
You got to eat.
You got to eat. Absolutely. You know,
and you might as well use the whole beast. So,
yeah, exactly.
But I don't know. Yeah, my mom used to eat the dubka.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Now, what is that?
Well, chicken ass, if you must.
Oh, really? Okay. Chicken ass. Okay.
And I ain't eating it. I'm sorry. I ain't eating it. I love you, Mom, but I ain't eating it.
No, my mom took up the baking side of things. So actually, just for Easter, she made some good Polish coffee cake. You know, the good stuff.
Yeah, we used to smoke sausage in our backyard. Mm-hmm. That was heaven. That was
My great uncles would case their own kielbasa and smoke them.
Yeah,
absolutely.
It's great. Absolutely. That was great stuff. Mm-hmm. There you go. Culinary tour.
With those dietary recommendations, let's move on to our fortnightly beer choices. So. And I'll start off. I'm drinking something new that's actually fairly good. And that is Devil's Backbone. It's from this Real Ale Brewing Company. And it's a local Texas brewing company. And it's a Belgian-style triple. So
nice and heavy.
Yeah. No. It's not heavy. It's
as very a triple?
Light. Yeah, it's very light-looking. It's an ale, actually.
What's the triple? So it's strong.
It's got to be 9% or more.
Yeah, not quite. It's 8.1.
Oh, that's a light triple.
Yeah. Yeah. It's a light triple. But
it's a deuce and a half.
Yeah. Yeah. but it's really nice and it's going down way too smoothly, if you know what I mean.
Uh huh. You on your second or third?
Third at this point. And what's interesting is because they are a hill country, which they're out of Blanco, Texas. On the underside of their caps, they have different Texas towns. So I have Marble Falls, Abilene, and Wimberley so far.
Wow, Wimberley.
You really is cracked the third one. That's
yeah, exactly.
It's why they call it triple, right? You're supposed to drink three at a time.
Exactly. You know,
he's on 9 as far as I'm counting.
Yeah,
that's something.
Well, you drink Miller Lite, right?
Yes, I do.
Yes, I do, but not tonight, Mark. I mean, yes, I did.
Yeah, so Sean, what are you drinking?
I've got ice ice cream. Yeah, call that what you will. As we were starting, my kids went out to get some soft serve, so they brought me some soft serve ice cream. So that's what I had tonight.
How nice
ice
is
cream.
It is. Like DQ soft serve or what?
No, DQ is crap. I mean, really? No,
I don't know. We have restaurants around here. If you eat there, they give you soft serve. But, you know,
yeah,
it's Texas.
This is a little podunk place. The family that owns it, the kids were just a few years separated from our kids. So we kind of know roughly the family. But no, it's like it's got cookie dough pieces in it. And it's otherwise vanilla, you know, soft serve.
Soft serve with pieces in it. Wow. That's cool. Yeah.
Yeah. It's tasty, and it's a good way to end your day. It's a terrible way to end your day, truly, but my kids have been just bones in for ice cream now that the weather started to warm up, so I didn't buy it. I ate it.
I don't know. My Belgian triple may have more calories than salt surf.
Yeah, no, that's very true. No, and Mark, yeah, I ran earlier. I'm good.
Yeah, you earned it. You're fine.
There you go. So Mark, what about you?
Well, so it's funny that you're drinking a devil's backbone, because we – in this area, we have a natural feature called Devil's Backbone. It's a huge bluff line on one of the rivers.
Devil's Backbone is a ridge that runs from Blanco, Texas, around in the hill country. I'm sure there's like probably 100 Devil's Backbones in that.
Yeah, country. Anywhere there's a ridge, there's a.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, I was like in Boy Scouts. I went to Philmont in New Mexico, and there was a place called Yuraca Mesa, but it was, I think, the Devil's Table was what it was, and it was it's a common thing. It's a, you know, give it an evil name, but anyway.
We've got Devil's Backbone. We've got Devil's Kitchen, which
Devil's Kitchen. I've heard of.
Yeah.
That's a pretty cool little hike, but I am drinking a Space Camper from Boulevard Brewing Company in Kansas City. It's the Cosmic IPA, and it's tasty. Now
that does sound tasty.
It's good. It's just a nice light IPA, so it's good summer beer. Mm-hmm.
And it's spring.
Yes. Well, it felt like summer in the shop, but I don't. That could be the vaccine. Talking. I don't know. It's been pretty hot and sweaty. My face
still sweating. Has been
feeling like it's on fire for the last 3 days.
I think.
Yeah, yeah.
I think
for those who don't know, Mark just got his second COVID shot. So.
Yeah.
COVID vaccine shot.
Speaking of soft serve emojis, I've been feeling like one.
I think this side of the Rockies, at least, we're in a weirdly warm time of spring right now. Like, I don't know what's moving through, but if you were feeling warm, it's not unlike that. It was nearly 80 degrees in Northwest Ohio today, and it's early March.
Well, you know? Yeah.
Wow. That's what it was here is 80 degrees.
Yeah, there you go. We were just like Texas today.
I was running the dust collector and a couple of machines, and it was like 75 degrees in the shop. And, but we had a front, and it was really, well, for this area, it was humid, but we just had a front move through tonight. So it's actually dropped 30 degrees in the last 4 hours. It's nice and cool again. And the sun came out right before it set, and we got a nice change of the weather. So it's still spring.
Right. Now, it'll change.
Gary, I went out and bought the vodka that you recommended the last time you were on, but I have not opened it yet. So I want you to know, I took your recommendation. I just haven't felt like vodka. Maybe tomorrow night after the COVID vaccine wears off.
We'll see. There you go.
Yeah, well, that'll warm you right up.
Well, then I'll feel like I've had like I've earned the hangover that I've been living for the last 3 days.
Right.
But what are you drinking? Gary.
I am drinking, first of all, I'm drinking out of a Wallapa Bay Goose Point Oysters shot glass.
As you do,
Wallapa Bay, very, very nice oysters. I'm having a shot of Bullet Bourbon.
Mm. All right.
Bullet Bourbon. So
yeah, I love the bourbon and the rye, yeah.
I've never had the rye. So
it's good. It's good. I'll drink the Bullet Bourbon. And then I'll use the rye to make Manhattans out of.
Oh, there you go.
Yeah.
There you go. Yeah, this is warming me up, so.
Yeah, yeah, that's good stuff, Thread.
Yeah, it's very nice. Very nice. Got some high notes, so very nice.
Well, with that, so Gary, if folks want to find you on the interwebs, where can they go?
Oh, geez. Well, northwestwoodworking.com is our website. That's number one. Splinters is found on all the – it's you can follow us. I've learned that you're supposed to use that word now. You can follow us on iTunes and follow us on Spotify and all those – and Google and all that stuff. Follow us. Yeah. Follow us, please.
Yeah, and if you're interested in taking the class, just go to northwestwoodworking.com, right?
Yeah, that's the best way to reach us. I jump on and off Instagram and waves, and I'm on Twitter at Gary Rogowski, and I think the Instagram is at Northwest Woodworking. So all those spots, but the website is the best way to reach us and get more information about the classes.
All right, fantastic. Mark, where can folks find you?
I am at Mark Builds It on Instagram and Plate 11 Woodworking on YouTube. But what you really need to do is go to plate11.com and subscribe to the blog, and you'll get everything important there.
That's what I do. Turn notifications on and just go for it.
Yep. That way you don't have to mess with the YouTube rabbit hole. You just, you know, just keep your focus. Watch the video. Move on to the next thing.
Yeah, I liked your last video. I love the videos where you go, all right, I screwed up, and
you're telling me. Yeah, I was just going to say that. I like that kind of pairing blowout, you know, repair. I like the judicious application of glue and use of floss. You know, it's awesome.
Hey, you know, if you don't make mistakes, you're not trying hard enough. Like,
there you go. That should diminish over time. If you continue to make the same mistake, you're doing something wrong.
Well, so the thing that I've learned over the years is, like, once you figure out how to solve a problem, it doesn't cause as much trouble in your life. You know, you just, okay, I messed up. Now I need to fix it.
Mm-hmm.
And I know how I'm going to do it, so I don't have to stomp and fuss and throw a fit. You know, you could sometimes you need to do that just to feel better, but
yeah,
especially if it's like a project-ending problem.
Yeah.
But yeah, like I said in the video, it's like if I can't fix this half of the top of this workbench is garbage. Like it's I don't know exactly what I would do. I'd make a short bench for the shop, I guess. But you know, I want to sell this thing, so. I better do my best to fix it. And it's completely invisible. I mean, the repair, you can't even tell.
Well, the little known secret is, as far as views and comments, yeah, if you screw something up and fix it, you get tons more views and comments than if you just say, oh, look at my perfect piece of furniture.
Well, I got one comment and like, you know, maybe 20 views. So I'm doing good.
You mean on YouTube or just?
No. I think I've got more than. I only got one comment. I don't get a lot of comments. And Gary, I'm not getting paid, man. I'm not getting paid.
Well,
but I am. I do feel like it's an advertising expense for my business.
Yeah.
And one day YouTube is getting paid. Oddly enough, I was appalled to discover that they are running ads in front of my videos, and I can't monetize.
Yeah, you haven't.
I don't have the requirements met.
Yeah, you haven't reached that peak yet.
Yeah, everybody go and watch all my videos, play them on repeat.
Yeah.
Subscribe fake people so that I can make 0.1 cents per view.
Yeah, right.
It's like record contracts, man. No different.
It's not a lot. You've got to have a ton of traffic. I don't.
Clearly, you need to be on TikTok dancing. As you show your benches.
That's a good idea. I
there
think.
You go. Or crying. Evidently crying.
Crying.
Yeah. Or making fun of my kids, like shaming my kids, stuff like that, you know.
Yeah.
Healthy things.
Yeah. Yeah, the internet is a very healthy place. Well, here we are.
You need a gender reveal workbench.
Oh, no.
That catches fire to a mountain.
Exactly.
Oh, God. Oh, God.
My wife would kill me. She's a fire ecologist. She would be very upset if I set the fire instead of her.
For sure.
What were we talking about?
Well, so where folks can find me is at Barton.Kyle on Instagram, or you can always hit me up on my YouTube. Just search Kyle Barton, and there's a pending video that I've highlighted a couple of times that I haven't got around to actually filming, but someday I will. So, Sean, what about you?
Wow, what a cliffhanger there. Most places you can find me is SeanW78, and you can find me on Facebook too. I don't post much there, but whatever. And that just about wraps up our show.
If you haven't already, please subscribe to the show on the podcatcher of your choice. Just search for the Modern Woodworkers Association. And while you're there, please leave us a review. You can follow us on Instagram at MWA_podcast. And if you'd like to support the podcast, go over to patreon.com/MWA podcast. But the best thing you can do is tell a friend. Word of mouth goes a long way in sharing our discussion.